Welcome to the Wise Women Diaries podcast. This is where shame and victimhood die. I am a woman that questions everything, so this podcast is a reflection of that. Here we speak on non-mainstream perspectives, like healing our childhood wounds, learning to trust ourselves, the voice of fear versus intuition, and how children are our teachers. We discuss what it looks like to own your power as a woman and step out of the medical paradigm. That's why I am obsessed with interviewing women who trust their bodies and babies in home birth and free birth, and their wild journey from maiden to mother. Ultimately, this podcast is for women who want to thrive and have inner peace, learning how to take radical responsibility for their life and shed victimhood for good.
Hi, I'm Emily. I am the founder of the Mama Wilder nonprofit, which is a 501c3 organization where we are a grassroots organization just fundraising for women in crisis, funded primarily by my social media presence on Instagram.
What about you're a mom? Because that's a big one.
I've got three kids and all totally different birth experiences. I'm a home birther. I'm daughter of the military, so I've lived all over the country. My second husband, we are raising a blended family of three kids. And together we started this nonprofit a year ago. And actually 5 years ago this week, I made the decision to leave my first marriage for the final time. And that was a monumental week for me because I started saving money and wanting to get out of that and someday have the life that I have now, which is crazy to think that that was like, if I had said to myself, if someone came to me in a dream 5 years ago and said, in 5 years, you're going to be home in a house that you're not renting because it's owned. You have two German Shepherd mixes. You have another baby, a boy, and you're divorced from that guy and you're with a guy that loves you and you love him. I would have been like, no friggin' way. So I'm very happy.
Because 5 years ago, you were in a hellish situation and you got out of it. And that's what this story is going to detail. Because you're really passionate about it. Because if this is your lived life experience. But really, it starts in childhood. Because in childhood, we are modeled what love is. Quote, unquote, love. Because, you know, a lot of what we are shown isn't actually love. It's just passed on patterns from our grandparents and our lineage that, you know, is just passed on. And they're not really awake to what they're passing on. So what was your childhood like?
Gosh, child of divorce. I like to say that one of the main reasons I was able to navigate a 4-year long divorce and custody battle was because I had for all intents and purposes, a pretty stable childhood, financially speaking, stable. But, you know, my parents were divorced. My mother comes from more money and maybe used that as a source of control. So there were a lot of conflicting things. Like my dad was military. It was stable financially. So we didn't struggle in the way that so many women, children have struggled growing up. And so I think that was why I went off to college. I had a degree. Like I was able to leave my first marriage with a college education and some tools to be able to support myself. Like I wasn't operating from the same toolbox that so many other people are in terms of childhood trauma. And so I lived all over the country. I used to work at a baby store here in Colorado, and my boss would joke that anyone who would walk in the door, I'd have something in common with them because I lived in so many places. So I definitely believe in the phrase bloom where you're planted. And I think that I do credit my military upbringing with why I've been able to move to the middle of nowhere. I moved here when I was 22 years old with my 9-month-old baby. I was a single mom and I started my life over. And I've started my life over so many times since then. And I really do think that having a military father is why starting over isn't really scary to me. It's an endless cycle of death and rebirth and death and rebirth.
Yeah, I want you to talk about how you got yourself into your first marriage, where then you were trying to escape. Would you call it, is it narcissist abuse? Is that what you call it?
You know, to be honest, I really don't like diagnosing people. Mm-hmm. because in absence of an actual true diagnosis, I think that a lot of people like to do that, which is so helpful internally. Like, this is what this is. These are these behaviors. But the abuse was so insidious and methodical and mirrored the way that I was raised, with a lot of financial control and coercive control. And so I really didn't, it didn't raise any alarms in terms of discomfort. It was very comfortable in the beginning. And I was very vulnerable financially, isolated from my family. I lived in a place where I knew maybe one person who was not reliable at all. And I encountered what a lot of single moms encounter, which is people view single moms as a charity case. They want to help them in a way that makes them feel good, like the benefactor feel good. And it was actually exploitative. And so this guy came along and I wasn't in a position to really say no. And in reality, I just didn't know what resources were available to me as a single mother of a young baby. And had I known, I think I would have made different decisions, because those decisions to pursue a relationship with someone who wasn't good for me were rooted in being financially vulnerable. And so I really didn't feel like I had many other options.
I want you to talk about the resources that you didn't know existed, that now you know existed, that could have helped you.
Well, I think I didn't know anything about what government programs were available. I had a big fear of that label of welfare queen. Growing up in a more conservative family, there was a lot of shame attached to that. And even though I qualified for all of those programs, I didn't utilize any of them. Like, I was working at a preschool and I had my daughter with me. She was one, and I was paying for her tuition, but my income fell within this, what's called CCAP. It fell within those limits, and I could have had all of that subsidized. And instead I was paying half of my salary in daycare just to go to work for 50 hours a week. And I kept her with me so I could breastfeed. But had I known that that was an option to me, I really do think it would be something as simple as, like, if I had known I could get free childcare, I would have probably never moved in with the man who ultimately became my first husband, because I could not say no when he offered it to me. And I really, for a long time, I really blamed myself for that. I don't blame myself anymore, but that's why it's one of the first things that I've pinned on my social media page on Instagram, was these are the government programs that it's so worth looking into, even though I genuinely don't want to rely on the government. The point is, we've been paying taxes. I've been paying taxes half my life. These programs exist for a reason. And it's, you're paying into a fund for so long. If you need it, it's there. And there's no shame attached to that. I've moved beyond the concept of feeling ashamed of that, but I wish I would have known. And it was something as simple as just, you know, if a WIC counselor had said to me, you qualify for this, here's what this entails, do it. I would have done it.
Yeah, my mom suddenly lost her husband when he was like 38 and she had six kids. And that's not something you plan for, right? Mm-hmm. And he thankfully died while on the job. So he fell under this category of getting this extra aid. But that's the sort of situation that you don't know how life's going to pan out. And so my mom was a mom with six kids, and government aid, those are the situations. It's families in need when they are blindsided by life that you cannot plan for. I want you to detail the financial control and abuse that eventually happened that I see you post on Instagram, because this is not talked about enough.
So the financial abuse for me, it was the one thing that, to be honest, I felt like I couldn't live with the rest of my life. There were other forms of abuse that I had convinced myself I was deserving of. The financial abuse, I could not reason with not being able to go to the grocery store anytime I wanted and buy food for my kids or put gas in my car. It was, you know, there were the behaviors that happened, like my phone would be shut off if we got in a fight. He'd turn off the internet in the house, change the password. He would, the one time he gave me his debit card to put gas in my car, I went over by 10 bucks or something, and he had disconnected my phone by the time I got home, which was maybe 7 miles down the road. We lived in a very rural community. I remember I had girlfriends over one time. Two of my friends used to drive down because they knew the situation was so bad. They would just kind of pop in and they would drive an hour to our new house. And I remember one time they were over and I asked him for $20 and he said, why? And at the time, it didn't really strike me as odd, but it was mainly looking at my other friends' reactions of like, that's not a normal thing. Why does she need to have a reason? It's $20. You're the provider. She doesn't work. That was the other thing. He didn't let me get a job out of the home. It was this, I would confront him with these things. Like, how do you expect me to pay for things? Like, my car insurance was always getting canceled because it was in my name. I remember I was always calling my mom for help back when she wanted to assist me. And there were just so many things that I was selling my clothes on Poshmark. Like, it was so not how a marriage should be when the man wants to be the provider and the woman is expected to just be the mom and wife. Like, if I'm going to do that, I'm fine with it. You need to provide for me. I have no problem staying home. I don't leave the house to go to work now. I don't want for anything because my husband recognizes that I need to be comfortable doing this. I need to have all my needs met. That was not happening in the first marriage, but those behaviors, the shutting the phone off, the canceling policies, the internet, all those micromanagement tactics, they were how I grew up. I grew up with someone who really had no love to give. And so this parent would use money as a weapon of controlling the people around her so that they wouldn't abandon her. And it's methodical. And that is a hallmark of narcissistic abuse, is to render your victim unable to escape. And so it took me a long time to realize, oh, this is how I grew up. That's why it didn't raise any alarms, because this is normal for me. This is how I grew up, my whole family, generationally. That's how my mother grew up. That was what was set for us. And so it didn't feel weird to be with somebody who did those things to me, because I didn't have an example. Like, I didn't spend enough time with my military father because I lived with my mother. So what was normal for me was financial abuse.
What do you feel like are more subtle forms of financial abuse that you hear from your Instagram women? Because this is something you post about a lot, but sometimes it's not very blatant abuse.
So one of the things I keep seeing, and it breaks my heart because I remember being in that situation, is a lot of women will, their partners, their husbands will demand an itinerary or a specific shopping list, and they're not allowed to deviate. They have to justify all of their purchases. I don't like to just say across the board, this is abuse, because, I don't know the intricacies of everyone's relationships. But that to me raises an alarm, because if you're expected to be home with your kids and you need to go get some school supplies or whatever, you should not have to wait for permission to do that. And I think the micromanaging of the budget and demanding to see receipts, and if anyone deviates from that, there's a problem. The threats of being cut off from finances. A huge red flag to me is when a woman voices concerns about her marriage to her partner, and her partner immediately jumps to, well, I'm going to take the kids and you're going to get nothing. If that's what he's jumping to, if that's his first reaction to hearing that his wife is upset, to me, that's a red flag. But I know that red flags are different for everyone. It's just reading that as a third party, I worry for that mom.
Do you feel like you covered learning what you were taught love was in childhood, and then that's what felt normal to you? And then do you want to talk about the whole court case, which is, are you allowed to talk about it, which is how you were able to like see everything?
Yeah, so I can talk about it. It took me, the timeline of my first marriage is pretty, it's brief because our divorce took longer than our actual marriage did. We married in 2018, and I filed for divorce the very first time, less than a year later. And I thought, if you file for divorce, that's it. You can go. Like, I had no idea what that whole process looked like, and I was really scared of the legal system. And so I filed for divorce the following year. And then I rescinded that, and things got worse. It became more physical. And then I filed again and actually left about 6 months later, 7 months later. And that was the first time I had moved out. He has a lot of opinions.
He's standing up for mom.
I'm gonna hold you. He's like, yeah, mom. So I did move out. We did a separation about 6, 7 months later, and I realized this was right before COVID started. And I realized, oh, I can do this by myself. I want this. I just want to do this in a way where I'm more financially secure. And so I made a plan. I moved back to the farm, and then COVID happened. And so 4 years ago, I came home from a trip to see my family, and I broke the news to him. I said, I am going to be moving back home, I thought. And this was like the week COVID started. And he said, what, can I come back with you to wherever you're moving? And I was like, I can't stop you. Like, things were cordial. We were talking about co-parenting because I thought, if I'm just nice, he will let me divorce him. Still had no idea what was going on. And so that whole summer, I was saving money. I remember a woman down the street was murdered by her husband, and she left him, and they had three little kids, and that really shook me. And at the end of that August, I got the keys to my place, and I just left, and I filed. And I think he really didn't believe that I was leaving and asked if we could date. I said whatever I needed to say to keep the peace, I thought. And then when it was clear that I was not coming back, things escalated and I had to rely on the protective measures afforded to me through things like protection orders and, police, which ended up really being irrelevant. But it was a long fight to just have peace in my life. And about 7 months after I left and filed for divorce that third and final time, he sued me for my eldest child that I brought into the relationship. That was terrifying. It was terrifying. It was suffocating. It was like being underwater and being held under, and there's nothing I can do. Like, I can punch and fight, but I can't get up to breathe. It was just an awful, paralyzing 3 years.
Is that the lawsuit that just ended?
Yeah, so that because the custody case by the non-parent for a bio child, it was filed in May of 2021, and it just ended a week ago, not even 6 days ago.
Yeah, I want you to talk about what you told me, that your mom funded it, that you represented yourself, right?
Yeah, so let me just back up. There were so many things that happened. When I left, I obtained that protection order, and a year later, it was violated a few times, and there was a criminal case that started. And that criminal case really put a halt on the way that we had been co-parenting and engaging with each other because jail was looming over someone's head. And in that time, I met my current husband, and we ended up getting married the day after my abuser was found not guilty. And we got married because we would have gotten married sooner, but we wanted to wait until the criminal case was over. And actually, during the criminal case, our relationship was outed on the record by my ex's attorney. And it was just that started the whole dehumanization and exploitation of my relationship with my new husband because he was a prosecutor. And so there were several people in the legal community who really found our relationship entertaining and trivial, I think. And in reality, we were just two young people trying to raise these kids and keep them safe from a stalker. And so things escalated on all sides with my husband's job and with our custody case, but we really put our heads together and we're like, let's adopt my eldest daughter. Let's have her be adopted because she never had a legal father before. And so while the custody case was pending, we moved to adopt her and did that ourselves because he's an attorney, he could do that. And that was finalized last year in January. And it was so poetic because exactly 1 week later, my husband lost his job there at the DA's office. And if he had lost his job any sooner, he wouldn't have been able to adopt her. And so it all worked out in a very serendipitous way without getting too woo-woo. I think it was meant to be, but anyway, that whole summer he was home with me and we had this amazing pregnancy and birth and postpartum experience. And we finally went to trial over my daughter at the beginning of this year together as co-counsel, essentially, because I was representing myself. He's not a practicing attorney right now, but he still has legal knowledge and he was able to do legal research and cite the law. And I put this case together. I put these cross-examination questions together and I did all the evidence. And I showed up and this attorney who my mother hired a year ago, he was against me. But I found out when I was pregnant with this baby, a year ago that my mother had hired an attorney for him. And when I asked her about it, I said, why are you doing this? And she said, well, if you let me see my grandkids, I wouldn't do this. And I said, okay, why don't you come see them? Like, if that's really all it is. And she's like, no, I'm still gonna pay for this. So now that that's over, it's like someone picked me up out of that water and now I can breathe for the first time in 3, 4 years.
Well, yeah. I mean, this is where your purpose is so clear. I honestly just want you to speak to women that are currently in really crappy situation because you were there and now you have a completely different life. Yeah.
I remember we lived on this farm in a town of 400 people, and it was the most beautiful view out my front door I've ever had in anywhere I've ever lived. I've lived in Southern California. I lived outside of Boston. I've lived in the South, but the view out my front door in Western Colorado was stunning. It was the West Elk Mountain Range in the Rockies. It was an interesting paradox because inside our home was actual like warfare. It was awful. And I used to lie awake at night because I had this window. I have a bedroom on the top floor looking out over the mountains. And I used to lie awake and I can look at the stars because I could see the Milky Way from my lying in my bed. And I used to close my eyes and envision just being in a relationship with someone who was nice to me and feeling a sense of peace being in my home. It was those two things that I would think about and fantasize about, and that would put me to sleep because my nervous system would calm down. And it was that thought of someday having a home where there was no of that warfare, of that stress. Like you walk into the home and it's peaceful. And that dream is what kept me going. I just wanted to find that. And so when I finally left, I had that for the first time. Like I had this peace that was tangible. Like I could feel it. You know, and it was before even I met my husband. And then when I met my husband, it was like one more person to love in our family, which was awesome. But just this idea of, having something, some sort of light at the end of the tunnel that you focus on, almost like tunnel vision. Like you have to block everything out and picture what you want your future to feel like. Because for me, that was really the only thing that kept me going and not wanting to completely end my life. And I blocked out a lot of that, of feeling like there wasn't a light at the end of the tunnel. And actually putting together this custody trial, I went back and I found a note I had written, which was a suicide note, because in living on that farm, I didn't want to continue my life. I wanted to end. I thought, I'm going to die here on this farm. Either he's going to kill me or I'm going to kill myself. And I realized then that would have meant he won and I couldn't. My moon is in Aries. I can't let anyone win.
What are tangible things that women can do to get out? Because you talk about this on your Instagram, but if this podcast is finding people that don't follow you yet and don't know and are in this situation, I mean, your nonprofit is one resource, right?
Yeah, so one of the things we do, which I really, it's interesting. My nonprofit started, I started getting this idea in my head, like, this is what I want to do. Actually, during the criminal trial of my ex-husband, because the attorney that actually outed my relationship with my current husband on the record, I remember she went up to the judge and she was like, Emily's using this trial as a promotion for her fundraiser. I was fundraising for a local mom who was in crisis, and it was an awesome, successful fundraiser. And I just remember thinking this, I had this thought, oh, that's threatening to these people. These attorneys are threatened by me having not only a voice, but being able to use the worst thing that ever happened to me as a way of bringing awareness to these situations and also encouraging other women. And so that was like, there were a lot of things happening in that moment, but I just remember thinking, oh, I like that. I like where that's going. Like having something that assists with all those issues that are real, like I can't afford a PO box subscription because I have a stalker and I just need an extra $90 to get a PO box subscription so he won't find me. Or I need my car insurance paid for this month, like small cash grants to women who have these needs that are really between, paying rent or buying food for my kids. Like, what am I supposed to do? I see that all the time. Like I got a message from someone. She's like, should I pay the mortgage or should I pay my attorney? And I'm like, Listen, I'll be the first to tell you, call your attorney and tell your attorney that this is the these are the decisions you have to make. Do not like don't think because don't think you're out of options. Just you might have to make a couple uncomfortable phone calls, but don't feel like you're at, I don't want women to feel like they're drowning the way that I felt like I was drowning. And so we do that. Like we're writing grants to women who want to get a doula, like single moms who don't have birth support. Postpartum meals, small cash grants that really are life-changing for these women in these situations because you don't need $15,000. Like that's, first of all, I don't have that kind of funding, but I would rather fund right now at least more women with these needs rather than like here's $20,000 to one person because that benefits one person. You know, that's not what I can do right now. So I'm really happy with what we've been able to do so far. And in terms of resources, I mean, luckily, I think since I've had to do this the first time, places like WIC, they're so much more aware of resources for women, like food stamps, therapy. If you can get on Medicaid because you qualify for Medicaid, get into counseling. Like, there are so many different things that will benefit not just your kids and you, but also show that you're really caring about stability. And I always tell people, focus on being the most stable parent. Don't focus on like the crazy wildest dreams of leading a retreat. Like just focus on being the stable, consistent parent and showing up every day. And then that's 'cause somebody's not going to do that. So try to be the most stable parent you can.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite amazing that regarding your childhood and the way a parent was with you with financial abuse and not really showing you love, that you're the cycle breaker, the way that you show up for your children. This is what I see in this generation, is we're like, no more. Like the cycle ends with me.
Yeah, it's I married somebody who was raised by women. He was raised by a single mom who actually passed when he was 12, and he was then raised by his great aunt who never had children. And he grew up in a big family of Southern women, and his mother was raised by a single mom. There was a it was a con it was a contrasting a contrast from how I grew up, which was there's shame in single motherhood. You should be ashamed for asking for help. You should be ashamed of, you know, bad decisions you've made. And then there was my husband's family where they're like, no, we're family. We're going to help each other out. No strings attached. Someone needs help. We're going to help you out. Like, screw what people think. And they're Southerners who weren't, you know, you think of like a bunch of Southern women and you think, oh, it's all 40-20. That's not how they were. And so, I married somebody who has a totally different understanding of money and what it means to help your family out. And so, it's been so refreshing to know that my kids get to see us, sorry, get to see us rewrite the script and, you know, talk about things like inheritances and leaving things to our kids and supporting them through their crazy dreams and not holding it against them when they make a decision we don't agree with. I never had that. I never had an example of unconditional love that I could see in front of me. Like my dad and I are super close and but for a long time, it was just my mother and I and whatever else she had going on. So it's been so nice to know that I can give my kids a totally different blueprint than the one I had.
To me, that's a miracle. Like to turn a life around like this, it's amazing. You're so cute. Oh my gosh. Anything you want women to know in regards to this topic? Or do you think you missed anything else in what you want to share?
You know, I think, and I don't know if your audience is primarily women going through family court or women who are just trying to break generational cycles for their children, but I really do. I think for me, it was really coming to terms with what shame is and like what it means to feel ashamed about these things. Like, I grew up in a family where appearance is everything, and I remember my mother even saying to me when I was a single mom at 21, 22, "We are not having a single mom in our family." Like, forgetting that at one point she was divorced twice and raising kids unmarried. Like, I inherited so much trauma and so much shame and so much internalized misogyny that actually coming to terms with that, they were related, realizing that we were all kind of shafted, my mother, her mother, internally about what it means to be a woman and what it means to like ourselves and like other women, that I had to really divorce myself from my upbringing and come to terms with what shame meant. And that meant doing things that were really humbling and admitting that I screwed up a lot. And it really took until 2 months ago that I realized I've done pretty well for myself, given that I wasn't given any of these tools before. Like, I was never, it really blows my mind, I think, to now know I started a 501c3 with my husband, helping women in crisis. And that was never something that was taught to me. I was never raised to think that we should be helping our sisters. We should be helping women. I was raised to be like, oh, she's a single mom. That's shameful. We should judge her. We should criticize her, you know, and that's, I don't ever want to give that to my children, my daughters. I had to do a lot of work on myself and realizing that my projection of onto other women had more to do with me. And once I kind of broke that down, the opportunities for relationship and connection opened up, like the floodgates opened. I've been pleasantly surprised with how many friends and women and strangers have wanted to assist me getting out of that dark place on that farm. And that support didn't necessarily come from the family that raised me.
Oh my gosh, that was perfect. And yeah, my podcast, the tagline is literally like, this is where shame and victimhood die. You alchemized the lineage shame, especially with being a single mother. So now your daughters don't have to carry that.
Yeah. And actually about a year ago, right after I got married, maybe 2 years ago, year and a half ago, I did some research into my ancestry and found out that my maternal line is a Jewish line, and it stems from Poland, and which means according to Jewish law, I'm a Jewish woman. It started with the first ancestor here in the States was a single mom. She had two little girls, and then she had a boy, just like I did, and she was divorced twice by age 29, just like me. And once I realized that, it was like the veil was so thin. I was like, oh my gosh, this is, I'm getting a chance to rewrite this, because exactly 100 years ago, my first ancestor from Poland here in the United States came here, and I don't know anything about her life. I just know like dates and times and ages. And I'm like, knowing that alone, that she had two little girls and she was 23 years old the first time she left her husband left her for abuse is what it said. And then she got married again, had a baby boy, just like I did. I think she divorced that guy too. Anyway, she had a couple husbands, and she, you know, 100 years ago, she didn't have the opportunities I've had. Like, I have a degree, you know, I've represented myself in my divorce. I represented myself in a custody case. I've gone through two criminal trials. Those things were probably so out of reach for her. And so in a lot of ways, I feel like this is some serious generational stuff here that we're rewriting for these kids.
That's insane. That blows my mind. I feel like I really take my guest's lead on like what their heart wants to share. So I'm wondering if you have anything.
What I see a lot is a lot of discomfort. A lot of things come up for women who are going through the system. And they find themselves confronted with the fork in the road. They could pursue one path, or they could pursue another that's maybe a little bit uncomfortable, but it might lead to greater rewards. And it just requires more work and maybe some self-exploration. And I really encourage people to lean into that and remember that if it's comfortable and it's what you've always done up until this point, and it's not serving you, it's okay to try something different. And you know, I said to my husband recently, I was like, the things I've done in the last 5 years used to terrify me and keep me up at night. I was heartbroken, destroyed, gutted, decimated when I became a single mom for the first time at 21, because I had all that shame of being a single mom. So to choose that again consciously and choose to be a single parent and risk maybe not ever finding love again, maybe not ever, you know, having someone to help me raise these kids, taking that risk was better than staying. And I had to sift through these layers of shame, but I've done so many things that genuinely scared the crap out of me in the last 5 years that now I feel like, oh, I've beaten all my fear. Everything that could happen to me that's awful has happened. Then I've survived every single thing. And like I told you about that, you know, the lumps in my breasts and having these health issues. I was like, great. Just got over that custody case. Now what's next? Are you going to tell me I got lymphoma? Like, bring it. Like, it changes your brain overcoming all these hard things. And so that you become really invincible and fearless. Like, I've confronted, you know, ideas and ideologies, but also I've confronted actual people who have brought my family harm. And when you get up close to someone who has tried to harm you, to me, they are all the same. They're scared. They're scared of people seeing them for who they are. And it's really, for me, it's empowering to, you know, to confront the thing or the person that is scaring the crap out of you. You get up close to it and you're like, oh, okay, I can beat that. Having those experiences over and over and over again, it's going to break you and mold you into the person that is the parent that your child needs. And I would have never become this person now, willing to go through all this crap to protect my kids, if I hadn't had to go through all this crap to protect my kids.
I'm so happy you said that, because my husband recently had an experience as well with someone, you know, quote unquote, scary. He realized, oh, this is just a very scared person. And that's what all of these people are, is they probably didn't get their needs met in childhood. And it created all these masks, all of this pain, all of these projections. Inside, they're just a scared little boy or girl.
Yeah, I remember there was an experience about 3 months ago. And I confronted somebody who, only because I anticipate once I share that I've been on this podcast, that people who know him and know me will listen to it. I'm not going to say who it is, but this is a very powerful person locally. And I walked up to him and I asked him very calmly. I had a sleeping baby on my chest, and this person has too much power. He ascertained, or he obtained, the throne in a very backwards way. Basically, should never have obtained the power that he has. He's in law enforcement. He has, for the last 2 years, year and a half, I loudly complained about this person. And coincidentally, 2 months later, he sent the police to my front door and arrested my husband and charged him with felony attempting to influence him. This is my husband's boss. Anyway, if you Google my husband, you Google my family, you'll see all of this stuff about my husband's criminal case. He went from being a prosecutor to a felon in a year. And the day the conviction, now everyone's going to know what I'm talking about. The day the conviction was read, or he was convicted, I walked up to the elected district attorney and I just said, "Are you happy?" Very calmly. The baby was still asleep. And I only know this because I remember this, but we got the photos back because they wanted to put it in a bleach report. And, which I actually ordered it to be framed because it's such a great picture. It's so perfect. There's a mom with a low ponytail, flat shoes, a baby sleeping in the ergo, and all these cops are like, their stance, you'd think that I was holding like a bomb. But I just walked up to the DA and I just said, "Are you happy? Are you happy?" And getting up close to this person who I would call him a tyrant, I could just see in his face, there's nothing there. And that's not a powerful person. That's not a leader. That is a crooked cop. He was never elected, first of all, which most DAs are, you're supposed to have him be elected, but his predecessor resigned midterm. But anyway, there's an epidemic of domestic violence in Colorado. 94 women died last year, which is the highest number that they've ever seen in recorded history. And it's just simply overlooked by the attorney general, by DA offices out here. And so I've been a very vocal critic, and it's no coincidence that my husband, who was a prosecutor, was discredited so publicly and humiliated so publicly so soon after I began criticizing his office. But getting up close to that person, I remember I went home that night and I was like, he reminds me of my ex-husband, because this is a small man who's so clearly troubled, doesn't like to be confronted. And it's the same fear of the mask falling off. And you get up close to someone like that and you can see it. There's just fear in there. It's like, it's hot air and fear. And so having those experiences of confronting these people and these things that are scary, and then you get up close and you're like, oh, there's nothing to be scared of. It's empowering.
Yeah, thank you for speaking on also that if you never got out of your comfort zone, if you never did something uncomfortable that felt edgy, you would not be where you are.
Mm-mm. No, like I think about the things that used to bring me strength. In fact, the week after that happened, or a couple days after that happened, I went to my therapist he had asked me, he's like, what is your, when you go to these events, you go to these court trials, you go anywhere where you know you have to be on, or you have to maybe confront someone or something, do you have armor that you wear? Do you have like a uniform that you put on, or some like something that makes you feel strong? And I said, I do, actually. I tend to wear black. I wear heeled boots. I have my hair big and blonde. I usually have very, very blonde hair. I said, I put on this, like this armor of like a, just a very, like a Fox News host, genuinely. It's what I kind of want to look like, but a little bit edgier. And I said, but this, confronting this DA, I had none of that on. I was in flat loafers. I had no makeup on, which I never go to court without makeup. My hair was low, a low ponytail. I had a sweater. I think I had COVID that day because I had no sense of smell and I'd been sick for a few days. I had like 103 fever in that courthouse. It was awful. But I had none of the things I relied on to keep me strong. And I was at my most vulnerable, raw state. I just watched my husband be convicted of felonies. I had a baby on my chest. My two kids, the bigger kids, were in the hallway in the courthouse. And here was this man who orchestrated this whole thing because he never convicted my first husband, but he convicted the second, the nonviolent one. I was so raw and vulnerable, and still like I still was strong enough where I didn't need that armor at the end of it. Like, that was just an accessory. I really didn't need to rely on that. So I'd done so many things over the prior years that I would have never had the balls to do that until, you know, confronting people like my mother or my ex-husband, this whole system, which is abusive by nature. Like, that's the thing that people don't understand. Family court doesn't exist for justice. It's not a justice system. It is a property division system. You go into the family court system not because your abuser is going to be held accountable. You go to family court to get in, get out, take your kids, and get safe. Criminal court, there's a sense of justice, but it's actually set up to benefit the defendant. So I think people go into this system thinking justice will be served. I'm just going to tell everyone everything, and I'm going to, you know, justice will be served. No, it won't. It's a system that is just as abusive as the people who are working in it and who use it as a method of harming others. And it's you have to let go of whatever false sense of security you have, thinking that justice will be served here.
I don't have any experience with family court, but I already try to live my life without government systems. So if I were to get divorced or whatever, I'd have to use it. Can you just talk about that? Because you are going to a system and like giving them your power, essentially, but you kind of have to. I just want you to talk about that because I don't have experience.
Going through the court system and seeing the two men I love most, which would be my father and my husband, devote their careers, their lives to serving the government, serving this country, and then both be dropped on their asses and discarded. I mean, my father served almost 30 years in the Marine Corps as an officer, and just the way that this country treats veterans is atrocious and embarrassing. And that alone made me want to not say the Pledge of Allegiance every day at my kid's school, if you know what I'm saying. But having a husband work so hard for his law degree and want to do so many good things with the criminal justice system here in Colorado, just to be completely betrayed by the people that he that once called us family, that has made me really, it's left a really sour taste in my mouth. And, you know, government involvement, now we're kind of getting off on a tangent, but I'm for limited government. I'm for less government involvement in my life. I think we should stop sending money all these other places and focus on Americans, because there are so many Americans who need help. But I think the state has too much power. And which is funny because I married a prosecutor. Like, why would I say that? But I've been on all sides of the system. I've been the victim in a criminal trial, a DV trial. I've been the wife of a defendant the first time, being stalked by the defendant. I've been the wife of a convicted felon. Now I've been the wife of a prosecutor. I've been on every single side of the system. I've been sued for my kid by their bio father. I've been sued for my kid by the non-bio father. Like, I have been, maybe this is a trauma response, but I can go into a courthouse and I don't get the sweats anymore, because I'm so used to it. That when someone asks me, hey, will you come watch my abuser's trial? I'll say, absolutely, I'll go. If it makes you feel comfortable knowing I'm there and I'm not scared by the system and these people, I'll do it. Like, it doesn't threaten me. They all know who I am on every side. And so it's a dehumanizing experience, because you can work so hard to not let the government in your life. But at the end of the day, if you get married, if you have children, if you own property, at some point, government's going to step in. And it's things like a prenup, or having a trust, or having, you know, working with a financial advisor to minimize government involvement when someone dies, that's great. But at some point, your property, your kids, your marriage is going to be impacted by the government. And it's, I don't like the words necessary evil, but it feels like that because I would love to, like, if it doesn't work out with my husband, just we divide our stuff and be done. Like, I have a girlfriend here who's getting divorced and they're doing it. They're filing together. And she's like, I don't understand why I have to still go to a hearing. Like, we've already signed off on everything. Why do I still have to get a judge's permission? Which is the craziest thing. At the end of the day, all these major decisions are being left up to people who don't know your damn kids.
Yeah, it's like judges are gods, just like in the medical system, the doctors are gods.
Yeah, it is the same thing. It's the same tyrannical meddling in every aspect of your life. And people, we're just used to it.
Another thing that I know you're passionate about that I don't have many conversations with in my personal life, so I want to have it with you, is why do these things like protective orders exist if they don't work? If they don't even protect women, and women, you know, are killed by their abusers or their husbands often.
Well, I recently read a quote that said something along the lines of that the state will never come down as hard on domestic violence as you'd think that it would or should, because at the end of the day, male violence keeps things in order. And that if men were actually held accountable for violence against women, there would be no men in positions of power anymore in government, in law enforcement, in businesses. Like, really, if we think about it, if every man who ever laid a hand on a woman or child was somehow removed from society and placed on an island, who would be left to run things? And the threat of women and children are the scapegoat, because as long as men can still hurt their wives and kids and generally get away with it, they won't turn their attention to coming after law enforcement and government. Like, I don't know if you heard, maybe not if it's not your world, but there was a judge in Maryland recently who was shot in the front driveway of his house by the dad that he ruled against in a custody case the same day. The guy lost custody of his kids, went to the judge's house and waited and killed him. And that kind of fear of, well, I gotta be lax on men who hurt women and children, because if we're hard on them, we'll come after us. We can't have that. I think the system itself is inherently misogynistic, but only functions because of the blood spilled by women and children. That's what is enabling it to continue.
It's very similar to birth abuse when women are abused during their hospital birth, which happens all the time. The hospital causes the birth emergency through big pharma drugs that are almost always given, right? That can cause fetal distress. It can cause hemorrhage. And so the birth emergency is created by the hospital, but then, oh my gosh, they're there to save them. And then the woman or the family gets trauma bonded to the system, and then they're a customer for life. And that's just perfect.
Yeah, it's very similar with law enforcement and this false sense of security and thinking, well, if I align myself with law enforcement, they'll keep me safe, when I know that it won't. And I mean, I married someone who was a deputy district attorney, and even the system came back on us. So it is completely a myth that aligning with these systems will keep you safe. Just like doulas who attend hospital births knowing they're not in the business of physiological birth. They're in the business of making a buck.
Yeah, and they can't. Most doulas don't have the power, or they don't want to go up against the system for you, because then they could be thrown out of the hospital and they could be out of a job.
That's exactly how I would describe a victim advocate that is hired by law enforcement. It's a good idea in theory, but it's a lot like most systems or rules that are set in place to support victims. They benefit law enforcement agencies. Anyone who's hired by a law enforcement agency or a hospital is serving the hospital or the law enforcement agency. They're not advocating for the victim or the patient. They're advocating for the hospital or the police department. So we have these people hired by law enforcement agencies, most times with like a criminal justice background. So they want to be in close proximity to police for whatever reason. But they are alleging to be supporting and advocating for victims when they're not. I mean, I remember right after my criminal case ended 2 years ago, one of the lead DA office investigators said to me, she's like, hey, I want to go out to lunch with you and talk about this stuff because I've got a couple victims who are not, they don't know how to advocate for themselves. And I'm thinking, I remember reading this text thinking, one of the lead investigators at the district attorney's office is asking me to help this person learn how to advocate for herself because she can't help her. What? You want me to, first of all, you want me to work for free. Second of all, I obviously didn't get the outcome I wanted because my abuser was acquitted. Why are you asking me to help someone that you are making six figures to help, but you want me to do it because I know what I'm doing. I know how I can go into a courtroom and talk to a judge. It doesn't scare me like it used to. For most women, that's terrifying. Just like for most doulas, they don't want to actually encourage their victims, their patients to, you know, go up against these doctors. They just want to keep things smooth, not make waves. It's the same thing. A doula, a hospital doula, and a police department victim advocate, the same brand.
Yeah, and these two systems, the birth system and the court system, all of this talk is basically just shattering the illusion of power and safety, that these systems keep us safe because you've lived it. You've lived it. And women that have hospital births and they're abused during their birth, they've lived it. And so it's breaking this illusion of safety and power to radically own yourself and take responsibility for yourself and your life. And that's what being an adult is, basically. But we have to like wake up to this because we kind of treat the system as our parent, like the big daddy government, right? And we're the baby. But it's like, nope, we're adults. We got to grow up and advocate for ourselves and advocate for our families.
Yeah, it's being a protective mom is a humbling experience that it is very unique. It is a unique path to be on. And it's, I'm a little numb maybe from the last few years and finally having the answer that I want. My husband and I have lost so much sleep in fighting for our daughter. I mean, my husband
married me at what would probably be the most vulnerable part of my life. It was when my abuser had been basically told by the people of our state that what he did to me was not domestic violence. And so my husband, rather than leaving me and being like, yeah, that's a lot, I don't want to deal with that, he married me and he adopted my kid, fully aligning himself with me legally and socially to give our family structure and stability. And so in that way, we had to use marriage as a way of legitimizing the relationship we already had built. And I would have not wanted to elope when we did, but like I never wanted to have two elopements. Like I wanted a wedding someday, but it was more of a legal decision and a business decision to keep our family intact than anything else. And it was one of the best decisions I made, but that was something that we've had to really do ourselves. No one handed that to us. Like nobody said, here's what you're going to do next. We had to really think about what were the best ways to keep our kids safe, and getting married and doing an adoption ourselves was one of those ways. And it was probably the best thing I ever did, was marrying him when I did.
I feel like you should end on a exit monologue. What has everything taught you, Emily?
What has everything taught me? That you can start over as many times as you want, that there is nothing to be ashamed about with regard to being a single mom, that it is so, there are so many people and so many systems that are threatened by the existence of a strong, protective mom who protects her family. And I've seen that play out for so many years in so many different situations, but most notably in the legal system, in the court system, that it is very threatening to positions of power, to people in the birth world, to people in the medical world, to people in law enforcement, in the court system, that women, a strong mom is very threatening to all these systems that patriarchy upholds. And it is an interesting paradox, being both maternal and soft and nurturing, but also scary and intimidating. And it's such a prevalent theme in so many different parts of society, that the existence of a lioness who protects her her cubs, that's the scariest thing in the world. And there's, I think there's a lot of power in that, in acknowledging that.